So yeah, it's just finding that balance. And I think in life, that's how you have to, what you have to do is try and find a balance. You can't just be all work, work, and serious, serious, serious.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Partners in Time. My name is Chris Granger. I'm the CEO of IWC Schaffhausen and your host on this podcast. During my time at IWC, I've been lucky to meet so many different people who connect with the brand. From clients and collectors, to engineers, to content creators, actors, racing drivers, pilots, and so on. And I've noticed many of these people share something. They share that unique focus and a unique passion for what they do. Now, on this podcast, every week, we're going to meet one of those partners in time. We're going to discuss what drives them, their passion, how they connect to time, and hopefully they'll be sharing some of their successes and secrets to success with our listeners. Now, time is precious, so let's jump right in and get started. To kick things off, I'm really excited to be talking to 7-time Formula One world champion and racing legend Lewis Hamilton. I first met Lewis, I think, back in 2013 when we just started working with the Mercedes-AMG Petronas Formula One team, and he just joined the team as well. And I must say, the journey that Lewis with Toto and the entire team, and of course also Niki Lauda, have really embarked on, what they've achieved over the last few years, is just nothing shy of absolutely amazing. You know, Lewis is somebody who's extremely dedicated. You know, he wanted to be a racing driver from a very early age, but he wasn't the most obvious candidate, being a karting racing driver in Stevenage in the UK, to pursue his career as a future Formula One champion. And I think the dedication that Lewis has shown over time, but also this attention for detail, his incredible feel for the car, and his unique ability to focus on the task in hand and the next race time and time and again, and deliver when it really matters, that just blows me away. And that's, I think, what's absolutely unique about Lewis. But also, the way he's used his platform to do so much more than just being a very fast and very excellent racing driver. You know, all through the Black Lives Matter campaign last year, and now with the Hamilton Commission as well, Lewis is somebody who's used his position and his influence to really raise awareness for all of the topics around social injustice, racial discrimination, and all those topics which we need to discuss today. And so I'm very, very proud to be speaking to Lewis today and get a little bit of insight into his way of thinking and his career. Lewis Hamilton with us. Fantastic to hear you, Lewis, from Bahrain, from the testing weekend and week. How are you? Thank you very much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really good to see you, and just come back from testing. We have 3 days of testing, and so all fired up for the first race.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's been a fantastic season for you last year, despite all of the adverse conditions that we obviously had. I mean, both for you personally and in all of the social change you promoted, but also from a racing perspective, has been fantastic. How's the downtime been in between the seasons just before Bahrain? Do you manage to recover? How's it been?
Honestly, it was a lot different to the previous years, just with travel restrictions. And I got a good couple of weeks with my family, which I was really grateful for. And then I headed off to the mountains and I was training. We didn't have a lot of snow, unfortunately. So for some reason in the States,
stayed in the UK. UK had plenty of snow.
Yeah. Yeah. For some reason, Europe was hit with plenty, but in the States where I was, we didn't have a lot. So it was very icy. And I know you're a snowboarder. I'm a snowboarder also, but it was just super groomy and icy. So it wasn't fun. So I didn't even do any snowboarding.
That's the thing. I mean, I'm mainly a skier, but actually after, I think I was 17 years off skis and then came back to it a couple of weekends ago, then felt like great because I could still do it, and then got a little bit cocky and that's the end of the collarbone. But I mean, this must be a concern for you as well. I mean, I saw all your Insta posts, obviously, when you're trekking up the mountain, which is what I used to do, not on snowboard or splitboard, but on skis. I mean, that was my army career back in the day. And seeing you hiking up there, trekking up there every day, I mean, how do you manage to, you know, obviously avoid injury and you want to get as fit as you can and mentally relax, but also you don't want to start a season with an injury. How do you do that?
I think it's just about just trying to find a balance. I think when I first got to Formula One, I remember I didn't start skiing until I was, I think it was like the first or second year of Formula One. I started snowboarding and I remember asking Ron, you know, can I go skiing? Can I go? Contractually, I wasn't allowed to. And I remember just the fear of, and the thought always of, you know, my whole racing career, I've never wanted to miss a race. And unfortunately, for the first time, I experienced that last year. And it was everything and more than that I had imagined. And so I think over this time, it's just been trying to find a balance. Because I think in life, you can't put things off. I've learned that firsthand with one of my closest aunties died of cancer around, I think, six years ago. And I remember she had said that, she's like, I've worked my whole life saving up to pay off the mortgage and I had all these things I wanted to do, but I've run out of time. I can't believe it. And it was one of the saddest things I had heard. So she was like, make sure you make the most of now. And so I don't hold back. I just try to do everything within reason. So for example, hiking up the mountain, I have a split board. So in the past, I used to hike up with snowshoes and then have to run down, which was not fun. As you're hiking up, you see everyone skiing down, having fun. Now at least the payoff for all the hard work going up, I get to sporting do a five minute run down. And that's kind of, it's just finding that balance. And I think in life, that's how what you have to do is try and find a balance. You can't just be all work and serious.
No, I totally agree. Because you do literally never know when you're going to run out of time. It's something I said to Paula as well during the pandemic is, you know, all the stuff we did with the kids just before, when you had the choice, shall we wait another couple of years? Shall we let them get older first? But I'm glad we did it. And I'm glad we continue to do what we want to do, because you literally don't know one day to another. And I think every time you get injured or you have a setback, it reminds you of that. You know, you just do not know. And exactly what you say about your aunt, you know, saying, okay, I'm working hard my whole life, I'll save it to retirement. It's a risky strategy for sure as well.
Yeah. But then you just have to just control. Like, for example, you were saying you got a bit ahead of yourself. You just have to just keep the balance. Like, I know what my limitations are. I know I can't do 360s and backflips, although actually I did do a backflip once. But I know that I know I can't do too much, you know, that's going to risk. So I just enjoy being with my friends and, you know, and with skydiving, that's probably, that seems quite dangerous, but it's actually fairly safe, I think. And I think you just take
all that. That's the surfing you should be worried about. You know, when I look at our friend Patrick Seabase, who got swallowed up by this wave in Nazaré, where all his rings were sucked off his fingers and he'd broken all his bones and was under the water for like a minute 20 or something. That's scary.
Yeah, but that's like the biggest wave in the world. So, I mean, I haven't yet got to that level.
2 feet will do. So I remember always in this sort of Huntington Beach, 7 o'clock in the morning, just waiting for some wave to come. So it's a bit more like that, definitely. Well, obviously, the weekend, what struck me as well is another legend in our sport, very sadly passed away, is Murray Walker. What was your relationship with Murray?
I met Murray when I was 10. When I first met Ron Dennis that evening, I remember I just won the British Championship, and to receive the award, you go to the Autosport Awards. And I remember that day because we couldn't afford a suit for me. So we borrowed the suit from the kid that won the year before. And I remember going around to meet everyone that I'd, you know, was aware of, and people that my dad told me, informed me who was there, getting autographs. And I remember sitting with, I have an image that just got sent to me of me sitting with Murray for a short moment. And he was just such an iconic figure. I think he just had such a great, he just had that special voice, you know, like those people out there that have those great voices, like Morgan Freeman. And Murray had one of the best commentary voices that you can that's been around, and he really brought excitement to the sport that that I don't think anybody else has been able to encapsulate. So I think he had a very long life. He gave so much to the sport. Was a real true gentleman, and you know, I tend to think that we, I like to think that we go on to a better place. And so he's on to the next adventures rather than it being the end.
Definitely.
That's how I like to look at things.
It's been an amazing season for you last year, as we said, you know, in terms of achieving now the 7 world championships, obviously then Tom Brady being a bit smug and equalizing with his 7 Super Bowls a few weeks ago. And, you know, that's a topic for later. But what struck me as well, I mean, you used last year in an absolutely unique way to really make your voice heard for social change, for pointing out a lot of the injustices. And I think as much as we thought it was fantastic that this moment happened, that the public conversation started, I see at the moment there's almost like a wave of different topics which go in and out of social media and the public conversation quite quickly. And now at the moment it's now women's safety against male violence and all the rest of it. And I see a risk that these things are sometimes also then off the public spotlight and get forgotten quite quickly. How has your experience been? And do you think we've already seen like proper long-term change, or is it still a journey that needs a lot more work?
Well, I tend to think that the goal is always to just move the needle, even just this, just even a millimeter, because if you imagine in the long, if you just move it just a small amount at a distance, it can be a big change. And I think last year, I think there was huge strides. It was unfortunate that it took a moment in time where people have phones with videos. There are, you know, obviously people out there that are experiencing horrible things and they are not being filmed. But I think it was a moment that the whole struck the whole world. It created conversation. You saw people in sports taking the knee. And what I think was really great about that symbol is that there will be kids watching and asking their mom and dad, you know, why are those people taking the knee? What's the knee for? And it's sparking conversation at home, perhaps an uncomfortable conversation that's not happened in the past. I think these things do, however, kind of the world moves so fast, the next thing comes up. And what's really important is to not let those things die a quiet death. What's important is, you know, there was a lot of talk last year, a lot of people claiming to want to be doing things. And I think this year particularly is about making sure that there's real action. I have seen steps being taken. I think what's really, really important is that we just keep challenging ourselves each day. I think ultimately we also, as a society, have to challenge ourselves and look upon how we treat people and, you know, have to honestly have the uncomfortable questions. Do we treat people differently because of their sexual orientation or their religion or the color of their skin? And we need to make changes. I think it stems down to education. So there are a lot of changes that need to take place. But I think we are seeing that. I mean, if you've just watched the news, for example, all of a sudden there are a lot more people of color on TV. If you look at brands now, are starting to be more diverse and seem to be including people from different backgrounds. So people are reacting. And I mean, you could even say, if you just look at just the other day, the whole scenario that's gone on in the royal family, for example, then you see the images following of some of the royal heads standing with people of color. So I think it's sparking conversation and...
Yeah, immediately.
Yeah. And I think that's a positive thing. And I think it's a real positive thing. And I'm seeing brands and people that are also... And it's not about being embarrassed about what's happened in the past. All we've got to do is say, you know what, we can do more. But together, united, we can have a big change. And I've personally seen that in my small circle.
Because I think a lot of people were fairly aware of very obvious cases of racism or injustice or unfair treatment or unequal treatment. But it's the subtleties in life that I think there is much bigger awareness for those things that maybe go completely unnoticed every single day. I mean, for me, for example, this whole Colson story in Bristol, I had zero awareness of, I mean, obviously I've been to Bristol many, many times, but had zero awareness of what that stood for, what his history was, what it meant to people of color, no idea whatsoever. Or when all the brand discussions started in the US on Uncle Ben's rise and all the rest of it and what it refers to, you know, I never would have looked at it like a second time as a child. It's just, you know, it's always been in the kitchen cupboard. You don't think about these things. And I think that's been good also that all of this discussion has brought up a lot of these topics to think, actually, is that really right? I mean, you know, is that something we should really look at? That
it's not your fault. It's from what we're taught at school. These are things that, even if you look today, for example, when we were growing up, we weren't a topic of discussion in geography or whatever it was not about climate change, you know? And I think these are things that need to be implemented in school. I think there is a responsibility for us as adults to also be making sure that the youngsters, my niece and nephew, for example, are being educated about diversity, inclusion. I think naturally we're born kindled spirits, you know, we don't see people differently. It's just in those first 10 years, you see social media, you see all these different things that tell you what is right and what is wrong, what is nice and what is beautiful and what is not. And these things need to be adjusted, I think.
You know, we're very, very proud that you're taking this stand that you're taking, that you keep fighting for the right causes. And we're immensely proud to, in a small way, to be able to support this through our relationship. So thank you for that. I want to talk a little bit about the season ahead.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to say, you're not a small part. You're a very big part. Don't ever underestimate the work that we're doing together. And I truly appreciate, you know, the conversations we've had where we've talked about how we can do more together in pushing for diversity. So it's no small thing.
Thank you. No, definitely. But let's look at racing this year. Obviously, there's some rule changes have already been implemented. Some rule changes are coming. Then there's a budget cap. And then there's obviously the big question of the whole transformation of motorsport and now e-performance coming in and how that will evolve in terms of Formula One. So how do you see that from the racing perspective? You know, going into the new season now in a completely different setup, maybe what are some of the challenges that you have to face in this particular season? And how do you think this will evolve in terms of new technologies coming in, you know, the whole reassessment of the sport in terms of the environmental impact and the technological advances that may come on the horizon? How do you look at that from a race driver's perspective?
Honestly, I think it's one of the most exciting times in sporting history, at least for our sport, because there is this huge discussion on climate change, meaning adding pressure to the industry, to the car industry as a whole. It's pushing technology further. It's making us have to move technology ahead further and faster than before to affect change. You're seeing sports, for example, have always had a platform, a huge audience. But I tend to think it has never really ever utilized that platform for anything but entertaining fans and bringing in money. As where now you're seeing a huge shift in all sports around the world, where they're realizing actually we have to do more with the platform we have to encourage, to inspire, to make change. And we already saw the start of that last year. I think we'll see more of that moving forwards. In terms of actual racing, I think it's an odd year because we've got the same car as last year, but it is different. We have different tires. The teams look drivers have moved around. The teams look like they could be closer. So I think plus we're still in COVID period of working in bubbles. However, I think last year we were only allowed in European countries. I think this year we might be open to go to the 23 races. And if that is indeed the case, I think we also can showcase how a sport can maneuver during these times in a safe and pragmatic way, you know, so I think it's super exciting, and I don't know where the technology is. I mean, at some stage, we're going to have to be racing electric cars. I think we pioneered it and started it back in 2009, which you're now seeing in road cars. And I think we will continue. I think it's our job to keep pushing that technology and making sure that we don't wait too long before we've moved fully And that's difficult for me to say, you know, because I grew up a petrolhead, you know, so I love V10s and V12s, and now I love electric cars, which is, I never thought I would say.
No, and it's an interesting question for the wider audience in the sense because, you know, it used to be back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, progress meant bigger, louder, more fun, you know, and it was very easy to relate to. And I think the image we have nowadays, like when we think about progress that is necessary for performance and environmental and noise reduction, all the rest of it, when you then turn around to people and say, well, actually, you have 100 miles of range, there's a muffler going to be on it, it doesn't sound like anything, it's a 2-liter hybrid, the excitement is not at that level. And I just watched one of the trailer for one of the performance cars that is electric from one of the other main German competitors, and they got all of their staff out to tell people how genuinely exciting that is. But it sometimes feels like you kind of need to make the point. But I mean, you're the one who's driven the AMG One and everything else. Please tell us it's genuinely exciting.
Honestly, it's just about changing your perception, I think, because I too was one that would, I remember saying, there's no way that I'm going to drive an electric car. I love the V12s. I love the old sound, the vibration that you get. I love the old V10s that we used to have, the 21,000 RPM. That was like, you know, one of the things that attracts you to a fighter jet coming by is the crazy noise that rumbles your rib cage. Yes. And that was like the Formula One car. So of course, and I think that's probably the passion people have for like, for AMGs, that deep growl that you have. And of course, when you go electric, you lose that. However, we need educating as to why it has to go that direction. And I think when you realize why it needs to go that way and that's the way it's going to go, you can get your mind around it. And for me, for example, being a performance driven athlete, the electric vehicles actually have even more performance than the cars, normally aspirated engines. The direct torque that you get from these electric vehicles is ridiculous. It's quite astonishing. But there's still work to do to have it have the same power and feel as a real engine later down when you're further up the road. But
even with the downsizing, I mean, honestly, out of all the AMGs I've driven, that little A45S with a new 2-liter, like on a mountain road, point to point, that's probably one of the quickest cars in the entire lineup. And yes, you don't have the sound anymore, but I mean, in terms of that traction, the way it goes around the corner, like at any speed, and it just keeps on going. I mean, it's fantastic to drive. It's just obviously that, like you say, the element of the sound is gone and that kind of roary feel is gone. But no, I'm excited, and I'm excited what the future will hold and all of the things that are to come. I want to talk to you a little bit about the racing element and something that I've been wondering about for quite some time. I mean, I've seen you a couple of times when you're in the zone, you know, when I'm in the garage or somewhere between the garage and the motorhome, well, that was still a possibility for us to come and see you. And you manage, and it seems to me like you manage no matter what happens, and whether you've had a good day or a bad day in terms of testing, training, whatever goes on, you manage to find that zone where you can fully concentrate and just get your mind into a space where you can focus on the racing, no matter what's going on around in terms of meet and greets, press interviews, things that may technically go wrong, other things that's going on. And I've seen you when I think you're doing that, when you then come to your car and you're like fully, fully focused. But it's something that I'm sure a lot of people are struggling with, to free yourself from these external influences and actually find that space where you can concentrate on the job in hand. Is there a secret to getting yourself to that place, or is it just training?
It's a really good question. And I wish that I had a spectacular answer for it in terms of, you know, yeah, the secret is this. The truth is, I don't think there's a secret to it. And I don't think there's necessarily a secret to success. It's really, the mind is so powerful. And I think it's really about finding what works for you. I've tried multiple different things to take away pressure, to allow myself to not be distracted, to give me that consistent focus in those races. You know, that's one thing that I take a lot of pride in, is the consistency that I've been able to develop over time, but it's taken time to do that. I would say it's a lot of it is outside effect. So, for example, for me as an athlete, you can't come to work with baggage. You can't have had an argument in the morning with somebody and come in and do the job to the best of your ability. When you come into the garage, you need to be upbeat because you've got to lift up a lot of the people that are around you because they need to know that you're riding with them on top form. Music helps. Listening to music to drown out the noise of the things that are surrounding me. There are lots of different things you can do. Like meditation is really does work. Taking a moment for yourself each day to kind of drown out the noise again that surrounds us in everyday life. Stretching, which I know not a lot of people do, but at some stage late on in their life, they're going to definitely feel it. But that's, you know, I think for me, it's looking within and taking a moment for me, to find inner peace and try and make sure that I'm centered. So that's what I try to make sure that I try to stay centered, and I can definitely feel what I'm being pulled one way or the other and feeling kind of off balance. And most often that's when I'm starting to make mistakes. That's when things don't go the way they should.
But do you sometimes when you notice that, and I mean, it's makes perfect sense what you're saying, but I think a lot of people find that a lot harder than you make it sound to try and make that transition from being totally pissed off and annoyed about something to letting the positivity flow when you come into the, you know, this can't always be easy. So do you sometimes take a step back and actually like not do something at the time you were actually supposed to do it for the benefit of then having a more positive impact on people? Or, you know, do you manage to just go, you know, drown that out? Yes, I've had an argument. Yes, I don't feel great, but, you know, I just focus on to the next thing. Do you sometimes just sort of, you know, hold back for 5 minutes?
And look, I mean, I'm human. So the thing is that I have just the same concerns and worries that people do. The same stresses and I, you know, sometimes I can't switch out of a negative mood but you've got to find a way to get past it. What I do notice is that you can't change the past. You've got to move forward. But I was spending more time trying to get in tune with my body over these years. And there's obviously podcasts about it. There's lots online about it. I think for a long period of time as a young athlete, I was just focused on training. I wasn't as detailed into what I was eating, what I was putting into my body. I wasn't really spending a lot of time studying how I could be more centered. I hadn't really discovered that part yet, and it's come with age. But geez, if I knew what I knew now, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, geez.
It's a different story.
Yeah, yes. We would be light years ahead. And so, But yeah, I also am.
You can teach people a lot of things, but not experience. That's what my boss always says to me in these cases. You have to make your own mistakes.
It is so true. You really do. Sugar. And I notice that with like parents often, don't do this, don't do that. And they're often trying to protect their kids, but they've got to make their own mistakes.
Yes, can't do it. Definitely not. So last question I want to ask you is, I was not just intrigued, I was fascinated to hear in your little chat with James Corden that your first ever watch was from Argos. Now, you know, that's a brand that's very, very close to my heart as well. So our legal team is already reaching out if we can get a three-way collaboration, Lewis Hamilton, Argos, IWC going. I think it'd be super exciting. But I'll have to ask you a little bit more. What was that watch from Argos you saved for months on end? Do you remember?
Well, it didn't. I don't even know if it had a name, but it was. It had a brown leather strap, and it had naturally a fake gold look. I'm just trying to think of the. It was very, very classy. Very, you know, way too old.
Classical.
It's super classic, kind of look. Way too old for a young kid, but. I honestly remember wearing it and feeling empowered when I had it. I was like, when people see this, this is a cool looking watch rather than the plastic things that the other kids were having. And it was £9.
Baby G's.
it was literally £9 for the, I think it was £9.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, £19, I think it was.
Mind you, that bought you a house back in those days.
Yeah. I was definitely really proud of it. The real one I had before that was a Mickey Mouse watch because I went to Disneyland when I was like five.
Those are cool.
Yeah. So
My kids are still wearing these smart bands from Disney World, you know, that gets you all the keyless access to stuff. And that doesn't even show the time, but they still wear it because they're so in love with their Disney experience still from 2 years ago. They still wear it around the house. I'm trying to get them to wear an IWC, but it's hopeless. No, but when you got the first sort of IWC on your wrist, you know, which was probably a big pilot, I guess, you know, the first watch you ever wore when you joined the team in terms of IWC, that must have been a bit of a shock upgrading to 46 millimeters and that size movement inside.
Yeah, because the thing is, I've always felt like I've got quite a wide wrist, and I like that. Mm. I've always just liked weight on my. I like knowing it's there. And when I was the big pilot was introduced to me. Firstly, it had the Top Gun logo on the back, one of my favorite movies. Yeah. And I was like, wow, this is cool. Because I've actually always wanted to be, at least try to be a pilot when I was younger, but it was never going to be an option for me because I was focused on racing. But fascinated with aviation. And so I love that tie-in that it had. And I was really, really just impressed with the timepiece. But more so when I came back, when I came to Schaffhausen, I never realized how many pieces, because that big pilot you can't see in the back, so you just had no idea how many little pieces were in the back of this watch that were specifically crafted for that. The innovation technology that you guys are creating it's mind blowing. So when you see that, your admiration for watches literally take off out of the stratosphere. And so I'm now like trying to think at some stage. I hope that we can one day make something that's not too ridiculous that normal, you know, people can't afford to buy, but something that's different.
Well, I've got a few ideas, and we've got some new materials as well, which come in, which I'd love to show to you at some point. We have to get back together and discuss that, because I think there's some good concepts that we can pursue. And also in terms of making like a mini series, I think that's quite exciting. Looking forward to that. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for explaining a little bit what's going on. Wish you all the best for the coming season. I mean, in a way, for all us racing fans, it's great to see when it gets a little bit tighter. It's less comfortable for you, but it's great entertainment for us. And I wish you're going to have a fantastic series of races. Stay safe, stay healthy. And I can't wait to see you again at some point physically, because that's still, you know, discussing designs much better in person than discussing over Zoom. So hopefully soon we'll be able to.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, all the best. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Speak to you soon. Thank you. Take care. All the best. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Next, I'm looking forward to speaking to Paul Ripke. Paul is a content creator from Newport Beach. He's a bit of a social media phenomenon. And some of you may have known him from his years of building the digital storytelling of the Mercedes-AMG Petronas Formula One team. Many of the greatest stunts in Mercedes storytelling history, including the one with Lewis Hamilton and Will Smith, have been curated and created by Paul. Looking forward to chatting to him. This is the Partners in Time podcast. Make sure you subscribe to never miss an episode. If you want to find out more, visit IWC.com. And you can, of course, follow us on Instagram. It's at IWC Watches. My Instagram is at Chris Granger Hare. Make sure you tune in. Speak to you soon.